This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
This evening's program is the third of six in a series of programs in the Silent Spring series, is what we're calling it, based on Rachel Carson's book, published 50 years ago in 1962, and launching the environmental movement. The supporters and the people involved in this program are not just one institution. While I'm from UC San Diego, this is supported by CSU San Marcos, by Grossmont College, Point Loma Nazarene University, University of San Diego, San Diego State University, the Fleet, where we hold these programs, which provides us with this venue. And tonight's program in particular is supported by the Sustainability Solutions Institute at UC San Diego. On behalf of that institute, David Woodruff, its director, is going to welcome you this evening and also introduce this evening's speaker. So, David.
The Sustainability Solutions Institute, housed at UC San Diego, has proudly offered the community 19 Greenovation Forums. These are late afternoon events, and you're welcome to the next few. I'll tell you about them in a moment, that seek to showcase a university researcher and link them to the business community and other sectors of our society. We've been able to do that with the support of the Scripps Foundation for Science and the Environment. This is the 19th such Greenovation Forum, and it's a privilege to join with Mike and his group at the Ethics Center and the six regional colleges and universities in bringing you this evening's talks on the theme of Silent Spring plus 50. Almost everybody knows now that Rachel Carson is credited with the founding of the environmental movement in this country. She did so by authoring a book called Silent Spring. She won the U.S. Presidential Medal of Freedom, the National Book Award, and then, what is the book about? It argued that uncontrolled and unexamined pesticide use, think DDT back then, was harming and even killing not only animals and birds, but also humans. She didn't argue against DDT. She never said ban DDT, but she argued that its use without thinking about it was very harmful both to animals, birds in the case of the book, and humans. And we now know that that was the case. And DDT was banned in this country and some others, but certainly not all. So here we are 50 years later. What have we learned? Where did the title Silent Spring come from? What you probably cannot read from where you're sitting is that it was inspired by a poem by John Keats. The title is in French. I'll tell you later if you want it. And it has the lines, "The sedges withered from the lake and no birds sing." Now, my task is not to talk about Silent Spring, but to introduce our two speakers, both of whom have backgrounds in things that have very little to do with DDT, very little to do with pesticides per se, but have come to understand their impact on our community, on our resources and on some of the important animals that live here in Southern California with us. You have a program that tells you a little bit about Jill and James, and I'm not going to read that to you here. So while Jill is getting ready to come up, I'll simply tell you that she is the water keeper at San Diego Coastkeepers, one of our life and resource-saving organizations locally. Her title is there for you to read. She trained in part at Tulane, a part at George Washington, and she has represented, she has carried briefs into courts on account of the Clean Air Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, and the Endangered Species Act. Would you please welcome now Jill Wilkowski, who will give the first of two talks.
Thank you and good evening. I'm Jill Wilkowski, and I'm here to talk to you today about pollution in San Diego, specifically water pollution, Rachel Carson's legacy here, what it means for San Diego, and what we can do to help. So a little bit about Silent Spring and why I'm happy to be here, actually delighted to be here. Silent Spring is meaningful for me because as a freshman at University of Notre Dame, I was double majoring in environmental science and political science, and I saw I was looking for my courses for fall of sophomore year, and I saw that there was an environmental ethics class, and I really wanted to take it, but it was all filled up with seniors, except they had slots available for people who had certain concentrations. So I started a concentration in peace studies so that I could take this class in environmental ethics, and one of the main books was Silent Spring, which became very, very powerful to me as an environmental advocate, as a young adult. Let me make sure of this. So Rachel Carson described Silent Spring as a cautionary fable to talk about what we do, what will happen if we don't think about our choices, about how we're impacting the environment. So it all starts off with a mosquito. Mosquitoes are a pain. They are a nuisance. They can carry disease, and we would like to get rid of them. So it's very important from a public health standpoint to control our vectors and control mosquitoes. One of the ways we decided to do that was through miracle chemicals like DDT. DDT was great. We're going to protect your children. Back in the 50s, it was protect your children, have wallpaper that has DDT laced into it, and you can even get Donald Duck on it. They had all sorts of PR about how DDT is good for me, and it was even so safe that people stood in front and were fumigated with it. But DDT being a poison, being an insecticide, is also a bioaccumulating poison. And that means it works its way up in the food chain. And what may seem small portions in water or in small bugs becomes a huge problem once you work your way up into the food chain into the larger animals. It specifically became a problem for eagles, falcons, and other birds. One of the problems that Rachel Carson highlighted in her book was the impacts to shells of different birds. And this here is an electron micrograph showing the thickness of the bird shells and how they actually decreased. They became less strong and more subject to damage. So this is a picture here of some mallard eggs that had been exposed to DDT, and they were subject to predators, and there was a lot of problems with it. So moving on, between Silent Spring from 1962 and this is a Cuyahoga River on fire, those two big events basically launched the environmental movement and a bevy of environmental laws, which I'll touch on very briefly. I'm not sure if any of you are environmental lawyers, but NEPA is the National Environmental Policy Act, and it was the law that in 1969 said for federal projects, you have to look before you leap. You need to take a look at significant environmental impacts. You can make a bad decision if you want to, but it just has to be analyzed. So it's a little law that could. Nobody thought it would do much because it didn't mandate good decision making, but it's really been a powerful tool for the public to get involved to make sure that projects have been researched for their impacts to the environment and to get the political process working. FIFRA, is the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act. It was originally around in 1947, but was completely overhauled in 1972. Partially in response to Silent Spring. And it basically controls pesticide registration. And FIFRA was the vehicle for DDT ban in 1972. TSCA is the Toxic Substances Control Act, which also talks about tracking, registering, and taking care of pesticides and or pollutants other than pesticides, food and drugs. That sort of thing. And the Clean Water Act, also in 1972, protecting our waters. So DDT was banned in 1972. But prior to the ban in 1972, there was an enormous amount of this chemical that had been sprayed in our waters, our marshes, our lakes. Think about how much you think it might be. Turns out it was 1.2 billion pounds that had made its way into our waterways. And it's still there. So two case studies, one from both from California, not from San Diego, one from Los Angeles, and one from San Francisco. So this story came out, the top story came out in 1994, that there was stubborn DDT in this canal in San Francisco Bay. Over 20 years, an organization called United Hecathorn dumped millions of pounds of DDT into this canal. It was a $12 million cleanup by EPA because the company had gone bankrupt. And there had been no progress. After $12 million of cleanup, there was actually greater concentrations of DDT in the canal and in the small critters that lived in it than before the cleanup. In Southern California, we had a similar problem. We had 110 tons of DDT into the coast of Southern California. That was a $50 million cleanup. The culprit? Storm sewers. Things that ran off our land and into the water, and now a $50 million cleanup off the coast of Southern California. So DDT was a problem. DDT is banned in 1972. What do we do to control pests, to keep our gardens beautiful, to help our agriculture? Miracle solution, diazinon, was actually invented in the 1950s by a Swiss company. They had problems with the formula until the 1970s, and when DDT was out, diazinon was in. So through the 70s and 80s, it was heavily used for domestic uses and for agriculture. So diazinon killing lovely cockroach-type bugs. But it also, when it gets into the water system, kills our friend the water flea. The water flea being an indicator species to show how it's impacting the whole ecosystem. But once it got into these small critters, it was impacting the whole food web. So diazinon, bringing it locally, diazinon is actually a problem in Choyas Creek. That's a star is where Choyas Creek is, and here's a map of the watershed. So right now, there's a plan for cleanup for diazinon in Choyas Creek. The diazinon was banned in 2004 for domestic use, but it's actually still used in agriculture. And so this is one of the pollutants that we're fighting against here in San Diego is diazinon and the effects of that. Well, if diazinon isn't a good solution to DDT, what else? So pyrethroids. I don't know if anybody has watched the show Billy the Exterminator. It's on A&E. But he is an exterminator from Louisiana. And he talks about humanely catching animals where he can, or humanely disposing of insects. And he talks about this great pesticide that he uses that comes from chrysanthemums. And it's all great. It's safe for kids and dogs because it's from chrysanthemums. That chemical is actually called a pyrethrin. And the synthetic version is a pyrethroid. So, hey, now we've got something that's natural or mimics something natural. That should be good for our environment, right? Well, locally we've been doing some studies, cities around San Diego, and we've found serious concentrations of pyrethroids. Pyrethroids are still legal, but they too are leading to a problem for our water quality. So that leads to the question, all right, how bad is it in San Diego? We've talked about diazinon, we've talked about pyrethroids. Pyrethroids aren't even a problem. How contaminated is our bay? This is a document, a chart that the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board recently released, and it's all of the contaminated sites within San Diego Bay. There are actually 36 of them. And some of them are sediment and water column, some are in the sediment or the dirt, and some are just in the water column. And these are where we haven't yet made a plan for, most of them are what we haven't made a plan yet for how we're going to address this. Over the next year, the Regional Water Quality Control Board plans to have a San Diego Bay Healthy Bay strategy to sort of figure out what are we going to do about all of this pollution. Do we have to dredge the bay and pick up the sediment and put it somewhere? Do we cap it? And how do we stop it from getting worse? What can we be doing? And as a note, this isn't all pesticides, but it's all, some of them are toxic and heavy metals. And the problem really comes down to water. We think about it, a lot of our, you know, we put pesticides on our lawns to make it great or to help our garden, but the problem is they don't stay there. When it rains, the water will wash them into our waterways, and it kills the unintended victims. This is the water flea and other members of the ecosystem. Fortunately, in San Diego, it doesn't rain that much, so problem solved, right? Not so much, because we have a thing that I like to call urban drool. These are all the different ways that pesticides and other pollutants can get from our land into our waterways from unintended consequences. So big potential sources of urban drool. We've got some power washing on the sidewalks. This is a huge pet peeve of mine, overwatering. And it doesn't necessarily even have to be sprinklers gone awry, but just sprinklers not aimed well are a huge problem too. We've got people washing their cars and it goes straight into the storm drain. And also big car washes, charity car washes. Just as a point of clarification for people who don't know, we've got what's called a separate storm sewer system. So in San Diego, when the water goes down the storm drain, it goes right into our waterways without being treated. In some places around the country, they have a combined sewer where the stuff that goes into the storm drain combines with the sewer and goes to the sewage treatment plant and ultimately gets treated. But our water is untreated. So anything that goes into our storm drains goes to our waterways. So how do we stop urban drool? You know, how do we take a part in stopping this pollution from getting into our waterways and making San Diego Bay worse? There are a couple different things that you can do as far as taking care of your own home and your own lawn. Making sure that your sprinklers are aimed properly, or making sure that you've got timer systems or irrigation systems that are sophisticated enough so that you're only using what you need. Not only is this going to help from a pollution standpoint, but it also should reduce your water usage and hopefully your water bill. Instead of power washing the sidewalks, you can sweep them up, sweep up grass clippings. Don't put those grass clippings in the storm drain because then that'll lead to actually nutrient pollution, which is also terrible for our waterways. But if you can sweep it up and bag it, that's another way to help use water. If you're going to wash your car, pull it up and wash it on your lawn, or even better, take it to a professional car washing place where they actually have to capture that water and send it to the storm sewer. So that water there does not get sent to the storm drain. But what else can you do? There are lots of other things that we can do personally to help solve this problem. First up, teach your dog to pick up after itself. Or if you can't, pick up after your dog. Do not fertilize before it rains. This is one of the best ways that you can ensure that your pesticides don't get into the waterways, is making sure that you use just enough for your lawn and that it's well before a rain so that it has an opportunity to soak in and doesn't run off. Keeping your garbage cans closed is another easy thing to do. And if you have oil spills or oil spots in your driveway or on your street, soaking that up with cat litter is a great option. These may seem like little things and not important things to do, but the problem is urban runoff, this urban drool, stormwater, is our number one pollution problem here in San Diego. And right now, our cities and the county and the airport and the port are spending millions upon millions of dollars, actually billions over 20 years, to try to tackle these problems. But the problem is it's not a... These aren't issues that the city can solve. These are issues that we individually have to take personal responsibility for. And if we all do our part, if we can change hearts and minds and attitudes and behaviors of ourselves, our family, and maybe our neighbors, our coworkers, that's how we get the problem solved for everyone. And one more final thing, thinking about potentially this is a big step, but getting rid of your lawn, using drought-tolerant species, native species that don't need the pesticides, that's an excellent way to help the urban runoff, to help pesticide use. You know, buying organic is another way to do it. We've got San Diego County actually has the largest number of organic farms in California. And so supporting our local businesses, buying organic, can all help reduce our pesticide and our pollution footprint. So if anybody has any questions, I've also got materials on the back table if anybody's interested in San Diego Coastkeeper and our organization, but there's my contact, and I'd love to hear your questions after the next presentation. Thank you.
It's probably easiest if we go straight to the next speaker. James Nye is going to tell you something completely different. James Nye came to San Diego from appointments at Harvard. He has done some absolutely amazing things discovering how bees of different types, not just honeybees, but bees of different types communicate with one another. So he brings a lot of biophysics and chemistry to understanding how organisms communicate. And as you will see in a moment, this ties in very nicely to the story of Rachel Carson plus 50 years. Please welcome James Nye.
Thank you, David, and thank you for this very kind invitation. Let me just pull up my presentation. So what I'll be talking about today is actually very related to the idea of a celebration of the anniversary of the Silent Spring, because right now we're faced, and perhaps you've even heard about this in the media, with a problem with honeybees. And one of the problems with honeybees is actually pesticides and how this is accumulating in bee colonies. So that'll be one half of the story. The other half of the story that I'll talk about today will be some pathogens, the things that diseases that the bees are getting, and there's actually a link between the two, because as you might expect, if the bees are sick because of the pesticides, they get more easily sick because of the pathogens. Well, why are honeybees important? Why do we care? Although the honey is delicious, what we really care about is the agricultural service that they provide. They're responsible for pollinating about one-third of U.S. crop species. Some of them are shown down here. And their commercial value as pollinators exceeds, by now, more than $20 billion annually. Just to give a small example, almonds. This single crop in California is worth $2 billion of product annually. Think about all those jobs. And as it turns out, we do not have enough bees, or soon we'll not have enough bees, to actually pollinate this crop. I spoke last week with a bee broker. They're actually brokers that go around and hire bees to pollinate almonds, and they're having a very hard time this year. It was a very difficult winter. There were a lot of colony losses. So this is something that not only affects our food, but really hits us in the economy at a time when it's not such a good thing. Well, why is this happening? I think that's a legitimate question. And in this cartoon, we have the idea that the colonies are collapsing. You go and you see a colony which is empty. Where did all the bees go? And this has been given a name, colony collapse disorder. And colony collapse disorder actually, in some ways, is not a complete mystery. This is data from the U.S. Department of Agriculture from 1945 through 2000. Actually around 2010. And the idea here is they keep track of the number of colonies. I don't know why, but in a certain period here, they actually stop keeping track. But you can notice there's a definite trend going on. And there are certain times you might notice here, there's a sudden drop. This was the introduction of the mite, Varroa destructor, but bees kind of recovered, but they still went on this long downward trend. The basic story here is not a story about bee disease. It's a story about the American small family farm. When there were many small family farms, there were many hobbyist beekeepers. Now we have relatively few. We have large agro farms that specialize in individual crops, and there really is less impetus for beekeeping. And overall, this is one of the main reasons why beekeeping has declined. But given this fragile state of affairs, that we already have a system that has relatively few bees, when we have major problems like we do now, we come up with insufficient bees to pollinate our crops. This right here, this red line, shows the number of colonies in the United States needed just to pollinate California almonds. You might notice an interesting thing is going on. They're going to converge in around 2014 and 2015. There will be not enough bees in the entire country just to pollinate a single crop, which is almonds. Now, one thing that's going on right now is that for the California almond crop, they actually truck in bees from all around the country, and they all converge in the Central Valley to pollinate because they are needed. But soon, even for that one crop, we will not have enough if things are not done. These are colony losses, bees that die in the winter over a series of years. You can see these are substantial numbers. So you might be asking, why aren't the beekeepers doing more? Why aren't they trying to play catch-up? And they are. Every season, beekeepers are trying as hard as they can to start new colonies, to split healthy colonies. And yet it's a race where in some cases they seem to be running in place. If they do their best, on average, every season they're going to lose about 30% of those bees. Well, why is that going on? I think here's a great cartoon that illustrates four factors that we know are behind the decline in honeybee health. So here you have the queen. And she's basically giving a monologue describing what's going on. So much honey remains, but our sisters are absent. And she's saying, here, let me show you where they are. Outside the hive, Julia falls, deformed wing virus, distorting her appendages. And viruses are a major problem. They have been imported from various places around the world. And what happens if we bring together, let's say, 70 to 80% of all colonies in the country to a single location to pollinate a single crop? These colonies are stacked on top of each other, right next to each other, and they move in and out of each other's hives, whether inadvertently or on purpose. And so diseases spread, and this is a major problem. Alice lies 10 meters northwest, paralyzed by Varroa destructor. This is a mite, and I guess in comparison to human body size, it would be the equivalent of a turtle sort of attached to you and sucking your blood. And this is what it does to bees, and it weakens them and causes their death. 200 meters west, the fungus Nosema serrani exhausts Victoria. This causes a kind of dysentery in the intestinal system of bees and is one of the things that our lab is actually researching. Sprays of neonicotinoid pesticides leave Ida disoriented. And in fact, we know that exposure to these pesticides causes a problem in bees being able to go back to their colony. So if they're not finding their way back home, the colony population is slowly dying out and you could get an empty colony. Bred fertility and productivity, weakened by constant travel from pollinating, you might add, Grace succumbs to the tracheal mite. This, again, is another common disease of honeybees, but usually one that is not fatal. 4 kilometers away, Clara finds... Sorry, it's hard for me to read on this. Floral patterns of white clover missing. So she's not finding the crops that were there that they used to pollinate. And this is also a problem of changing in the ecosystem and perhaps the loss of lands that were formerly fields to development. Winter nears, and we will need too many of us. We shiver to warm our empty home. And here you see a beekeeper standing with a bunch of empty colonies, which is very much the situation that we have right now. The beekeeper who helped me, Alan Mikovich, told me that he lost this winter at least 40% of all his colonies. And he was doing his best. He was checking them. He was feeding them. He was medicating them. And yet we have this situation. So what is going on here? And the first thing I wanted to talk about is pesticides. This really first came to the fore with this idea, backed up by research, that certain types of pesticides, particularly the neonicotinoids, are responsible for causing bee death. And many studies have been done showing that these pesticides even at very low doses, can affect bee learning, memory, and their ability to migrate home. And in fact, right now the European Union is considering a ban on these pesticides for many types of crops. There have been individual bans. For example, in France, you can't use it on sunflowers, but now the entire European Union is considering something far more drastic. But this is not just a problem for agriculture. You might recognize this shelf. It comes from a local store. And just for fun, I went there and I took this picture, and then I went to check to see which of these pesticides contain neonicotinoids. Basically, everything here by Bayer Crop Science, recognizing the blue bottle, contains imidacloprid, this pesticide that we did our research on. And understandably, Bayer's not very happy about this. This pesticide is worth billions of dollars to them, and it is arguably something that does help human food production. We are able to grow and be so productive because we're able to kill pests. But there are unintended consequences, and now we're going to have a social debate about what do we want. Do we want to try to protect the environment and the bees, or do we want to try to maximize the human crops of food that we grow? Now, what's really interesting is this was heralded as the latest in the line of miracle treatments. And in many ways, it's very ingenious. So what you do is you have the pesticide and you have a seed. You dip the seed inside the pesticide. You then plant it in the ground. And from this, a plant blooms and grows. But you might notice that this sunflower is covered almost like by a red force field or shield. What's going on here? This pesticide is so toxic that the amount that's on the seed is incorporated into all the tissues of the plant. And so now you no longer have to spray. This is the great advantage. But this plant has the poison in every single cell of its structure. And so an insect comes along, takes the nectar, takes the pollen, or drinks the sap, and they will be killed. And so this is one of the keys why this pesticide was developed. So you can see that most of the harmful crop pests are actually affected by this pesticide. But it's an insecticide, it's a pesticide, and bees are also insects. So, as you might imagine, bees are also affected. And a bee that comes and takes the nectar or the pollen can also be exposed to the pesticide. Now, arguably, they're exposed to a very small portion of it, but it can build up. What does a bee do? She takes the nectar, she brings it back, and she concentrates it into honey inside the nest. So honey is not just from a single flower. It is from hundreds and thousands of flowers that are highly concentrated. It's not only the honey, but also the pollen. And what's quite interesting, and I think very similar to the idea about DDT and some of these other pesticides, is it builds up in the bee colony. We've now done tests on the wax in bee colonies, and scientists have found evidence of pesticides that were banned years ago. So they're still there, and the bees are still being exposed to it. And it's building up into this very odd cocktail. It's not just one or two pesticides. There could be hundreds of pesticides. And if you were to go, for example, into your medicine cabinet and you hadn't cleaned it out for a few years and just randomly took one pill of every type of pill that was in there, you can imagine what the consequences would be for yourself. And so something similar like this is happening with bees, where we have unintended consequences of all different mixes of pesticides. And I just want to add that one of the ones that we learned about in the previous talk was one that was extracted from chrysanthemums, pyrethroids. And it turns out that one of the most lethal combinations for bees is a pyrethroid plus something which is not an insecticide at all, and that is a fungicide, something designed to kill fungus on plants. People would have never thought that this would be a problem, and they're not individually. When you combine them together, you get a synergistic effect, much like drinking and certain kinds of medications. It's extremely toxic at very low doses to bees. So one of the things that we were doing in our lab is trying to see how bees respond to a low dose of insecticide. And here in this video, what I'm going to describe is the experiment. We take a bee and we harness her in here. She's not hurt, actually. We release her afterwards. And we can tap on the antenna. And the normal response is that if the bee actually thinks the sugar solution is sweet enough to drink, she will actually extend her tongue. You can see that, and she's actually trying her best to drink. So we can use this assay, and what we're doing is we're trying to say, does it alter a bee's sweet tooth? Bees, like some humans, have sweet tooths. And it turns out that the bees that like the sweet stuff are foraging for nectar. The bees that don't like very sweet solution at all collect water, so that's logical. And the bees that are in the middle tend to specialize on collecting pollen. However, what's unexpected, and here we have pollen foragers and nectar foragers, is this is the sugar solution that they would normally like, a relatively low concentration of sugar, which is what you normally find in natural nectar. It's not very sweet. But if you treat them with the pesticide, they suddenly develop an intense sweet tooth. Now, why would this be bad? Sugar is not bad for bees. The nectar is what they need. But imagine if you start rejecting the nectar that's out there. If you are not going to accept and feed from that flower because it's not sweet enough for you, this would cause an overall reduction in the number of calories that are going into the colony. Fewer calories, fewer bees, the colony will eventually dwindle in size. So this could be one cause of the problem that we're having with decreasing colony size. We're not saying that this is the cause of colony collapse disorder, but we're saying this could negatively affect honeybee health. And actually, there are many more other studies looking at these neonicotinoids, which show that they cause other effects. Bees are unable to fly back to their nest, and they die outside. That, over time, will result in fewer bees inside the colony. Now, I just wanted to touch, because there is actually a nice synergy between what we're doing now and this interest in clean water. It turns out that honeybees collect a lot of salt through water. They need salt in the way that we do, and they don't get it from pollen or from nectar. But they can get it from water, and a very common thing is that if you have a muddy area, you'll see the bees drinking because they want the salts that are in that muddy water. But how are these pesticides applied? We put them on the seeds, we plant them in the soil, and we irrigate. And bees are very attracted to this kind of irrigation water. And not only are there pesticides in there, but they're there at much, much higher concentrations than they would be in the nectar. So this is one problem that we're studying to try and see if honeybees are being exposed to pesticides in their collection of dirty water. We're also trying to figure out if there's a way that we can actually put something in the water that would prevent the bees from liking it. There are certain chemicals like potassium, which is found in fertilizer, which bees do not like. And if we could determine the right concentration, maybe adding this to water would be helpful in preventing bees from trying to drink it. But it's something that we're looking at. Now, let's talk about the disease, that other part of the cartoon you saw earlier. So, Nosema serrani first came from Asia. It came from this bee, Apis serrana. And in 2006, it was first linked with this colony collapse disorder. Again, we don't think that it causes colony collapse, but it does weaken the health of the colony. And that is the critical thing. All of these factors that we're talking about, the reason why we can't really find a smoking gun is probably because there is no single smoking gun. There's a combination of factors that's contributing to bad colony health. So here we have Apis serrana, and here we have our honeybee here, Apis mellifera. This actually had its own Nosema, but the one from Asia is now commonly found as well. Now, how do bees get infected with Nosema? So we have the ingestion of contaminated food. They might ingest or work with comb, even as they're cleaning out, for example, a cell where a bee was born. They might be exposed. There is trophallaxis, and that's a fancy way of saying they exchange food to each other. This is part of the process, for example, of making honey. And then finally, we have nurse bees that go around and they feed the baby bees. They feed the brood, and it's possible that they are transmitting this disease to the brood. And that's very interesting because this is the thing that we're working on right now in our lab. What we do is we want to have this in a very controlled situation where we know what the bees are getting. We want to know that they are getting a certain dose of this disease, Nosema, which is a kind of fungus. And we want to make sure that everything else is controlled. Honeybees do exhibit hygienic behavior. Left on their own, nurse bees can remove diseased larvae, and there are other things that can happen as well. So what we do is we take it into the lab, and we can actually raise bees inside petri dishes. And you'll see a video of how this works in a moment, but here is a young larvae, and as it gets older, it finally begins the metamorphosis, and it becomes an adult. So here in brief is how we do it. So I don't show the final stage, but they actually then are in these pupation plates, and then they will turn into the adults. So what we've done is sort of fun. We have actually removed the nurse bees from the equation, and we have students that are taking their place. So this is one of the students, Jacqueline Ho, in our lab, and she is a great nurse bee. She's very dedicated to coming in, feeding them, and then taking care of them. Now, when they get to the adult stage, when they die naturally, we then harvest the gut contents, and then using a microscope, we count the number of spores. This allows us to determine if the larvae could be infected, which is the goal of this experiment, and what is the degree of infection. So here are the results. It turns out that this disease can infect the baby bees. They can infect the larvae. And we see it in the adults. It decreases the survival of the larvae and the adults. And consuming about 10,000 spores per bee leads to more spores inside the bee at death. Now, that might sound a lot, but these are very microscopic small things. So that's actually a fairly low dose of spores. Now, one interesting thing, which is the next stage in our experiment and actually gives us some hope about ways of dealing with this, is that when we give the bees a larger spore dose, they don't seem to be infected as adults. And I'll just show you the data. These are the pre-pupae. This is many days after we've given them the spores as larvae. And you can see that at both treatments, they have elevated spore counts. But what's quite interesting is that the adult stage shown here, only the lower dosage of the pathogen has actually resulted in more infection. These guys that had the 40K managed to fight it off, it seems. And maybe their immune systems were activated by the larger dose, but that smaller dose kind of crept under the wire and was not detected and later came back to haunt them. So that's the question we're focusing on for the future, which is, can we actually activate honeybee immunity? We know that bees, which are bred to be naturally resistant to this disease, have certain immune genes that are activated. We know that severely infected bees will have their immune system compromised if they are not resistant. And we also know that this is a type of disease which is called a Microsporidian parasite. So one of the interesting things that we're trying out, and we know this is very speculative, but we'd like to see whether or not we can use it as a vaccine. So in rainbow trout, which are infected also by Microsporidian parasite, what they did is they simply took the parasite and they killed it in an autoclave. And they injected it back into the trout when they were young. And then as adults, they saw whether or not they would show infection in response to the disease. And in fact, it worked quite well. There was 85% less subsequent infection. So what we're proposing is actually due to the same thing. And one of the research projects that we have going on right now is we plan to inoculate the larvae, the baby bees, with the vaccine and see later on as adults if they are actually resistant. Another thing that we're exploring is you probably have heard about the beneficial effects of consuming probiotics. In one experiment, it turns out that probiotics fed to bee larvae actually activated their immune genes. So we're going to do the same thing, but now we're going to take it to the next step, which is we hope to activate their immune genes and then see as adults if they are actually resistant to this pathogen. So these are the two students. This is Matt Endler, and it's going to be his master student project. This is Adam, who's working in the lab, and they're busy trying to feed the bees and take care of them. So I wanted to end sort of on a high note, which is I think that what we're doing here, raising awareness about the environment and basically passing this information on to more people and to the next generation, is very important. Science outreach plays a large role in the research that we do in my lab. And if you're interested, you could actually go to the website. You can just Google Teaching Bee, and you'll find this website. Each of these flower petals actually has exercises for students. And in fact, in the petal for educators, we've developed exercises for high school students and junior high school students and college students. Most recently, we developed a high school curriculum with Jesse Wade Robinson at our local high-tech high. And this addresses three national science standards and really teaches several skills related to the scientific method, but using honeybees as a system. So there are PowerPoints there, there are lesson plans, there are worksheets. Everything that you would need for this is already there and is free to anyone who's interested. And in general, if you are interested in learning more about the research in our MyLab, particularly about honeybees and colony collapse disorder, you can just click on this tab. We also have a Facebook group, the Teaching Bee group, and there's even a YouTube channel called The Teaching Bee, which showcases some videos from the high school students and also in general about the research we're doing in the lab and about honeybees. And again, you can just Google my name and you can find all of these sites. So I wanted to thank you very much, and I really appreciate coming here and talking to you.
I heard three very important issues that I think we can all take as take-home lessons. One, that we know this, but we often forget it, and that is that many of the things we do have long-term consequences. Rachel Carson's book was written over 50 years ago and helped to a great deal to stop the use of DDT, but we're still looking at residual DDT 50 years later that can't be cleaned up. And if that's a problem, it's something that the cat is already out of the bag, so to speak. The second that I really liked from James' presentation is something that I hear about in various disciplines, like in the transportation industry, and that's to be wary of assuming there's just one cause of a problem, and to look more deeply and see whether, in fact, there may be several issues. And we talk about the collapse of honeybee colonies, it may not be just one answer. And I think that he illustrated that nicely. And once you hear that, it's obvious. If somebody said, why do human beings die? We die for all kinds of reasons, and we die more easily if we've got other problems, other toxins in our body, other diseases. We become more susceptible to other things. That's not surprising, but it means, and that's the third thing that I was going to bring up, that it's complicated to try and figure out how to address this. It's complicated not just because there are many causes, but because there are many effects we're looking for, and both of you illustrated that there are reasons why we use pesticides, and some of them have to do with trying to have crops that we can feed people with. But at the same time, we are potentially causing toxicity to ourselves, to the other animals that are part of the of our environment, and to some of the animals that would allow us to have those crops. So this is not easy, which is why I think that James and Jill do not want to try and solve this on their own. They'd like your thoughts or your questions. So you're welcome to join us with some observations here.
What is your opinion about reopening the south end of the bay and flushing out all these things you think we would be better off without?
You know, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that before. Although we have been doing a lot of work in South San Diego Bay. I don't know if anybody heard over the weekend we had the implosion of the power plant that was in South Bay. And, you know, one of the questions there is what's going to happen with the turtles who were attracted to the warm water from the bay, from that power plant. You know, I think it's not necessarily so much a question of the flushing. It's, you know, stopping the pollution that we continue to put in there. The metals, the copper, the nutrients that are on our streets and on our roofs, and that wash down. So I think instead of something drastic like changing the face of our bay, I think having smart solutions to address the pollution that we have now and taking individual responsibility to avoid future pollution is our best solution.
Other questions? Let's see. Good. Okay. One more. Well, I think we've got time for one more, and then I'm going to...
Well, I was going to hold off on this because I'm fairly ignorant, but over 20 years ago, my children and I went out in East County, and we painted on the drains, you know, little dolphins and, you know, little placards that said, I am downstream from this. And frankly, I have not seen any improvement over the county. Now, I don't work in the elementary school system, but it seems to me an obvious answer is to have programs aimed towards school-age children where they are our advocates, where they can go home and say to dad, don't change the oil on the driveway. Look at the oil running down in the driveway. You know, or mom, do we really need to use these pesticides on the roses? Because I do think that that is our major problem. I mean, I love San Diego. I've been here since the early 70s. I am just chagrined. I came originally from the south, farther south than you even were in Louisiana, and went to Seattle, which has had tertiary water treatment to save their Puget Sound since the 60s. You know, and to come down here and to go out to the beach and to see signs that say, you know, don't surf, don't swim, you know, because it's full of pollution and sewage and all. It's ridiculous. It's just a matter of dollars. It's a matter of will, where we're going to put our dollars, you know, whether we want to do it for a sport arena or whether we want to have our beaches clean. So I think the only hope is going to be to get an army of children educated enough that maybe they will open their mouths. I mean, we've brought up our kids to be a little more assertive now. Open their mouths and say, you know. And so are there programs? My feeling is no, there isn't concerted programs that we're still trying to talk as voters, adult to adult. And I've gotten old as an adult trying to talk, and no change has happened in San Diego. Is there any school programs?
So James and Jill, first, do either of you want to argue against the idea we should educate children? I suspected not, but I know that James mentioned some things that he's doing that are, I think, intended to try and reach out to children, and I'm sure that Coast Keeper probably does too, but it would be good to maybe quickly summarize what each of you know is in place.
Yeah, I completely agree with that sentiment because I was that kid, and I actually still am that kid. When I go home to my parents' house in New York, I'm like, oh, that's recyclable. You should. Why are you throwing that in the trash? Close the refrigerator. You shouldn't leave it open while you're cooking. So I completely agree, and San Diego Coastkeeper does have a program that we work with the city of San Diego called Project Swell, which is bringing environmental education to elementary school students. We also run that program in Oceanside, and it's basically focused on urban runoff and water quality issues. With that said, we're not reaching enough kids. We need to reach everybody. All the students should be having this curriculum and should be advocates for clean water. You know, another program that San Diego Coastkeeper is starting developing right now with our community advisory council is a high school based program, which would be high school student leaders, environmental leaders, and bringing them in and empowering them to make change in their community to help water quality. So it is happening, but it definitely needs to be, there needs to be more effort, and all of the students should be able to learn about that.
I agree. I think it's a great idea to keep on educating, and it's very difficult convincing hearts and minds, even for children, but I think it's something that's done one step at a time. I'm part of an effort called the San Diego Citizen Science Alliance, and right now they're seeking funding. It's a large alliance of university and colleges, many of the ones which I believe have sponsored this event, and if it goes forward, we will be trying to educate in that way.
Somebody just stood up. You can ask one more question because I hate to have younger people not get a chance to ask their questions.
Thank you. It's not so much of a question, it's a comment. So one of the things, and I'm very familiar with Coastkeeper because I work there, but one of the things that we have issue with is not so much educating kids, it's educating teachers, particularly when we're talking about elementary school teachers who don't have a background in science. It's very difficult to get some of those teachers to implement science lessons and environmental science lessons in their classroom, not because they don't want to, but because they don't have the background in it, and they're so focused on other things like reading and writing and arithmetic and testing for those subjects. And so it's not that we don't have these programs, and ProjectSwell is a great example of that, but we offer ProjectSwell free of charge to all teachers in San Diego Unified School District for elementary level, but only a fraction of them can actually implement them in their classroom. And that's another policy issue, getting people, getting parents, getting teachers, getting community members saying, hey, this is really important. Environmental education is important for students, and it's important that we focus on this in our school system.
That seems to me like an excellent comment to end with. Thank you. So I'm going to try to just sort of, because we've heard a lot of, I think, really good things tonight, I'm going to just take a brief moment to summarize at least five things that I heard that can be done, some that we're working on. Unfortunately, I think they all cost money. But the first one is to perhaps find alternatives to the insecticides we used. We actually, the first program in this series, looked at some of that. And I think that's something that you've both addressed that it would be good to do, although sometimes those alternatives aren't the best choices either. The second is to decrease the number of lawns in an area that doesn't have much water. It is in a variety of ways a problem here. Third is a tiered pricing system for the water, and that relates to a fourth one, which is simply to put the real prices on things. I think it just again and again, I mean, how much does a crop cost? How much does water cost? And we have done so many things to subsidize that in the service of something that's important, being able to create a sustainable farming industry. But at times we've ended up propping things up in a way that make it more difficult. And finally, this seems to be a theme in all of our programs, is education. The next generation, as several of you now have just mentioned, and education means not just educating the young students, but helping the teachers so that they can do that. So those of you who think that this is important, and it sounds like we had nobody who thought it wasn't important, or you didn't get up to ask a question if you did, if you think it's important, then you need to find ways to make that statement, to say, here's some support for these programs. So I want to really very much thank James and Jill for their excellent presentations tonight. And David and this Sustainability Solutions Institute and Scripps Family Foundation for helping support tonight's program. All of you for your conversation and for being part of this discussion, and also for the discussions you will continue to have after tonight. As you know, this is a part of a series. Please join us for the coming programs. Next month in March, we'll have another take on this Silent Spring issue that has to do with infectious diseases and the way changes in our environment may make those infectious diseases more difficult to handle and some of the things we should be thinking about for that. And finally, before you leave, please fill out the evaluation forms, and we look forward to seeing you at future programs. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.